Welcome to Regulated and Relational, the bi-monthly podcast produced by the Attachment and Trauma Network. Today, the studio is full. Anna Paravano and Jen Alexander are joining Ginger and Julie to talk about how we can create a classroom environment or a home environment that is more regulating. Let's join this interesting conversation.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Regulated and Relational, the podcast produced by the Attachment and Trauma Network. I'm Julie Beam.
And I'm Ginger Healy.
And we're excited to share with you, from both our personal experiences and our professional knowledge, what it truly means to be attachment-focused, trauma-informed, and how we can help children impacted by early childhood trauma. Today in our studio, it's full. We have two guests with us to talk about their new quick guide. Jen Alexander, who is a veteran educator and counselor and longtime friend of ATN, and her partner in this venture, Anna Paravano, who also is a longtime ATN friend and previous board member. And she has a background in interior design and teaching at the community college level. And they have united their superpowers in a really amazing way. Ginger, would you like to give our listeners some more background?
I'm so happy to do that. I'm going to start with Jen Alexander. She is an experienced educator, nationally certified counselor, and school-based registered play therapist. She is a passionate leader in the movement to build trauma-sensitive schools. She is also the author of Building Trauma-Sensitive Schools, Supporting Students and Staff After COVID-19. Currently, she travels to train and support our nation's educators full-time so that she can help others help kids. And that isn't even her full bio. We could go on and on about how amazing both these women are. I would also like to introduce you to Anna. Anna Paravano is a professional interior designer and consultant with over 40 years of experience and 30 plus years as an instructor at the community college level and a curriculum developer focused on adult vocational education. Anna holds a master's with an emphasis on design and human response to environments. Late in life, mom, she calls herself, through adoption to a child who has experienced complex trauma, developmental delays, autism, and PTSD. Anna switched her life focus to become a trauma-informed parent in attachment theory and practice, regulation, and resilience therapies. She is the owner of Growing at Home, a series of workshops, including trauma-informed design and creating spaces that promote self-care and regulation. And boy, I hope we can get into all of the details of all of that, because the two of you really are so innovative in your work and so healing in what you do. And one of the reasons that we're gathering all together today is to talk about this quick guide, Creating a Regulating Classroom Environment, a Guide for Trauma-Sensitive Educators. I just love that topic. I think that really sets the stage for what we want to talk about and what we want good news to spread about. So let's dive into this quick guide and then pull out some things from there. Jen, do you want to tell us how it came about and what you want to share with everybody about the quick guide?
Sure. Thank you so much, first of all, for having us here today. We're so excited to talk with you about our new quick guide that we wrote and to talk about the series, because there's really a series of quick guides. And how these came to be is that in my work of training educators, working as a consultant, leading trainings, I've had lots of questions come up about various topics, from is yoga helpful for kids at school? What do we need to do in terms of do's and don'ts for classroom environments? What about executive function and working memory? How do trauma sensitivity and anti-racism go together? How do we apply a trauma sensitive lens to supporting all of our colleagues and students or family members who are part of the LGBTQ plus community? So many topics that relate to trauma sensitivity that can really help us think about how to build a safe and supportive school environment that's good for every single one of us. So these quick guides are really intended to be quick reads for folks. They're a laminated guide that are 8 panels. Think 8 pages of information with graphics, bullet points, things to lean into, things to lean away from, very practical advice that's linked to what we can do right here, right now in our schools to be supportive of not only our students, but also our adult nervous systems so that we are creating healing-centered communities that are good for all of us. So this first one is all focused on how do we design classroom and school spaces that promote regulation for both students and staff.
That sounds amazing. And that's where I really want to hear from Anna, because she's such an expert in just that niche area of designing spaces, especially, you know, trauma sensitive ones. So do you want to take that, Anna?
So why trauma sensitive? It's such a step to the side for interior design in a way, because we think of interior design as beauty and comfort. And I like it. I don't like it. I want it. I don't want it. My neighbor has it. Why don't I have it? Saw it on House and Garden television, all that sort of thing. And good design will improve the quality of your life. But trauma-informed design is about creating places and spaces that start from the inside out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'd studied this since the 1980s, quite frankly. It wasn't a sell anywhere. People didn't want to hear about it. They wanted the anecdotal, oh, if you love purple, then you must be imaginative, creative, and love wizardry. You know, things like that, which is, okay, that's really cool, but it's anecdotal. This is different. It goes much deeper. And I think for many of us and being in parent groups over the years after adopting my son, we discussed amongst us how children reacted to environments and what was happening. I mean, in my own home, I'm watching an antique Duncan Fife coffee table being thrown across a room. And I'm like, oh my gosh, family heritage just smashed against a wall. So there's something wrong with this. There's something I need to think about with this as a professional, not just as a mom, but, you know, what's going on here? Getting deeper into how do people respond? What is the expectation about the environment? What do children relate to versus adults? It's very different. When you're living from hand to mouth and on a survival gear, you really don't care if you have a frilly 4-poster bed. It has no meaning. It goes back to what we know about trauma and healing. You know, it's all about relationship. You know, we talk about relationship person to person. This is relationship person to environment. And then attachment is the antidote. Attachment to space is the antidote. Making it relatable, making it trauma informed. We're calling it that, but it's all about universal design, universal accessibility for all people.
There's a lot for us to unpack there. The whole idea that it's different for children and different for adults, and that it is universally accessible regardless of the background that you're coming from, regardless of what's happened to you. But talk to us a little bit more about that, especially in relationship to a school. I guess there's a big difference between school design and classroom design, right? What I do in my own classroom versus what the school does altogether. How do those work together? And does the guide cover both of those things, or mostly focused on teachers helping them set up their classrooms?
That's a really good question. Our guide can be used in both directions, and think of it as information that's grounded in research, grounded in the wealth of information that Anna brings from the design perspective in terms of what's good for humans and what's empowering for humans. So often we think of what happens in a classroom in terms of the setup, or even in the wider school environment that you're talking about in terms of how it's set up, it's often thought of in terms of decor or a theme or colors. Mm-hmm. And too often it's centered in what that educator prefers. Mm-hmm. And so part of what Anna and I talk about with educators is to say, this isn't about you. Or another way to think about it is, it's not only about you. Mm-hmm. So we're not thinking about teacher and centering your perception of what you want your classroom to look like, or what kind of theme you want to approach this year, but to rather think wider, but also deeper and more personalized in the sense of what is going to be empowering for all learners in your classroom, yourself included, how do we help bring their identities into the space? How do we bring voice and choice and the quantity of gobs into your space while you are also facilitating changes that are doable in your environment that help people regulate? And so when I think of regulation, I think of, okay, what might be too much for folks? In an elementary classroom, there's often so much stuff, much clutters, so many things. And some of that's a storage issue. Some of that is just, we want kids to have an enriching environment. We want them to have access to information, to books, to things they can touch and feel because we know that enhances learning. At some point though, all of that stuff becomes clutter and it becomes too much and it becomes hard for people to filter out what they need to focus on and engage with. And we know that for people who are experiencing big stress, whether that's youth or adults, that can become one more level of sensory input that's just too much for everyone. So in some ways, we're talking about what's too much and how do we lessen it. We also know that there can be a tendency, often more in upper grade classrooms, for there to be not enough stuff. So maybe not enough personalization, not enough things that are novel and capturing engagement, attention, or helping kids connect to who they are and who they are in community together. So how do we identify places that might have not enough? And how do we become intentional about not only what we're placing in those classrooms, but how and where and what's our purpose so that we're more intentional and how we put that room together? And again, we're thinking small changes that are doable, whether that's in a counseling office that the counselor's facilitating, a classroom that the teacher's leading, the front office. We're not necessarily talking about architectural design, although we could, and there are things in the guide that could help you think in that direction. Mm-hmm. We were really hoping to speak to any educator about changes that they would have the power to make.
Yeah, I think that's the key too, is what can you do? Not becoming overwhelmed with everything, but maybe just choose one thing or a place to start. I'm just sitting here like thinking of one of the schools that I worked in and picturing that front office and what the things you could do there. I don't know that I've ever thought about that too much, but I think that's pretty powerful because it's like the first thing that parents often see, of mm-hmm. course, and students. And so that would set the tone. That really has got me thinking. I love that idea.
I'm at Cal State Northridge right now at university, and we're proposing a study on rethinking classroom design for the college and university level, because as Jen mentioned, there's often not enough mm-hmm. going on and it's just bare bones. And here you have 18% of students are food insecure, housing insecure, living out of their cars, working, going to school, and barely, you know, can put body and soul together. We need to think of them and how do we comfort them and how do we help them feel at home? Some of my students are in the classroom between school and lab, 10 hours a day. Mm. It's a lot. I mean, they live there and it's gray and it's dark.
There's nothing comforting or attractive to look at on the walls. There's not necessarily comfortable seating. Yeah, any of that.
I had the privilege of joining one of Anna's courses this semester as her students shared their trauma-informed design projects at the end of the year. And one of the things that struck me in their presentations and their projects that they really poured themselves into in such an intentional way was the idea that design isn't just about what we see or how we feel in a space, but it's how we use it, how we interact with it, mm-hmm. and how it meets our needs. So that idea of notice the need and meet the need is all about relationships, but we can think of our relationships to space and how we come in community together in an environment as a way to meet our needs. And one of the things that I was so impressed with our students as they were talking about was statistics like she just shared and taking that information and then incorporating it into design. If we have that high number of students who are housing or food insecure, how do we make food accessible in our environments? And how do we do it in a way that folks don't have to seek it out, ask questions, but it's readily available for whoever might need it when they need it and in a way that's not stigmatizing? That's the power of trauma-informed or trauma-sensitive design. And we're using those terms interchangeably, but I think that's the power of what we can do in our schools is use design to help notice the need and meet the need.
That's an amazing example, Jen. Thanks for sharing that.
I want to talk more about being aware of our response, you know, how our nervous system responds to colors to patterns to textures. Like, that fascinates me. And I think that's where we don't have a lot of background or education that we could use.
I think there's so much culture and style and fashion that's become involved in color and pattern and what's in and what's out, that early on, we lose touch with what we're actually feeling about a room, you know, because maybe it's Aunt Susie's house and we're supposed to like it because we like Aunt Susie and we want to be polite, but inside we're screaming because she's got striped wallpaper and plaid upholstery. And maybe it's not the aesthetics of it. Like, oh, that doesn't go together if you're five. It's more like, that's a lot of energy. Oh my God. But you have to sit down and have tea with her and be polite, you know, because that's what we're supposed to do. So in growing at home and the work that I do, it's about being quiet and bringing yourself back to that moment. We make a decision about color, pattern, all of these things within 3 seconds of seeing it. Like a blink, it's an autonomic nervous system response, and it's very fast. And when it's trained out of us, we don't even know what happened. But when we hit a red light, a green light, a yellow light, we don't think, we do. You know, but that's socially acceptable and safety conscious and all these good things around it. Again, you know, the impact of culture and training and education and repetition. But also there is a neurological component to that and what we see as red and why red is stop and not green. Mm-hmm. So getting back to those more intuitive, more just authentic who we are. And it changes for people. You know, we can say that red is a more aggressive color and that it can raise your blood pressure. And there's studies all about this. Okay. It raises your heart rate, your blood pressure, increases the flow of the salivary glands. You'll experience more hunger in the sight of red than any other color. Blue would be the opposite. But then you have the cultural component, you have upbringing, you have personal relationship with color. So the guide gives you a good introduction to many things about that. But then in my work at Growing at Home and my teaching at the university, we dive in. We get totally into it. And, you know, those are the kind of workshops that I do and I've done with Jen. For educators, it's been a really cool experience.
If I'm an educator and I access this quick guide, is that going to give me somewhere to start? I mean, I understand the concept of this isn't necessarily all about me. Although if it was about Julie, the classroom would be green because that's what she always wants, whether she consciously tells you that or not and consciously picks it. So it's not about me. How do I notice what the students need? How do I figure out how students are going to react? Or does the guide give me some basic guidelines of what I should do that would be most beneficial for all the students?
I feel like, Julie, you've just described our writing process. With all of this depth of information, and I'm the person in our process who came in and said, okay, how do we make this tangible, relatable, and usable for educators? And that's really the beauty of these guides, of being able to collaborate and then work together to put it in language that teachers can use, especially when they don't have a lot of extra time. And so the guide is organized in these 8 panels, and it gives information, tips for using color. It gives other do's and don'ts, very specific things to try. It has some facts connected to it. There are downloads that come with the guide for free that include handouts. People can jot down notes, kind of their takeaways of what they're going to do more of or less of, but also lesson plans and activities are there that folks can use with their students to help them get in touch with how they're responding to things in their environment. So they're increasing awareness of self, because regulation is really an inside job, right? It's about what's happening inside our bodies and being attuned to self as much as we're rooting everything in relationship to others, to our community. We're also relating to self. And so it's very practical in that sense. And I used one little piece of it in a training this past week. In fact, I was in a library. It happened to be a group of elementary educators. And this library happened to follow several of the suggestions that we have in the guide that I don't see happening in a lot of other environments. So it was a really cool example. The walls were neutral. They were like a kind of a creamy tan color, not a stark white, but a neutral color. And we talk about how important it is in the guide with Anna's suggestions to have our big spaces be either a neutral or cool color, and then have your pops of color be in smaller doses, if you will, mm-hmm. and to think intentionally about where those smaller doses will be. So in this library, with this neutral background, there were blank spaces on the walls, a focal point of a bulletin board that was really brought your attention to that space. But the most color in the room was on the books. And so I said to folks in the room, let's look at this room. Where does your eye tend to go? Where do you perhaps see color? Mm-hmm. And so folks were pointing, like, our eyes go to the books. And then I said to them, is that where you want your students' eyes to go in this school space? And they were like, yeah, we're in the library. We want students' eyes to go to the books. Wow. That's trauma-sensitive design right there. Mm-hmm. So thinking ahead about that, being intentional, that's just one suggestion that we give in the guide. There are so many more that are like that, but the folks can hear that or read that, understand an example, and think about how can I apply that in our spaces too.
But we also talk about personalizing it for staff, you know, because it is also about the staff. It is also about the educators, where they need a spot for themselves with their own things that they relate to that are regulating for them, their touchstones, or in your case, Julie, your green. You know, how do you bring that in for yourself without having to dominate the room? It's individualized for children, but also for the adults who are in charge, who need to also re-regulate if they're managing a lot of different things in that classroom. You need a break. You need a place to be, and that feels like yours.
I mean, I think we all know how important it is for that adult to be regulated in order to help the kids. But I'm sure we haven't really sat down and talked about all the different ways how. And I love this specific idea of having a spot or space or just color or something that helps. You use the word on a like touchstone or something that really kind of grounds you and brings you back to that. I just love practical tips and strategies like that, that we can really, you know, dive into.
It's the shifting of a paradigm. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about culture in the beginning of our conversation and how our society works and what is good design, what's in, what's out. This is truly the shifting of a paradigm where it goes beyond what you watch on TV or what's cool because your neighbor has it. It's about where is the body? What is the relationship we need to create? We have the privilege, the opportunity, the education, the resources for the first time in the history of humankind, and the awareness to be able to do something like this, to have a quick guide about designing classrooms. And I would encourage any educators out there that are listening to this, or parents, that if it's not your style, don't worry. Mm-hmm. This all evolves. You need a starting point. To me, I look at it as a hospital room. Because I remember that Duncan Fife table flying across the room and thinking, oh my God, that it's so tasteful and it's antique. What's happening here? Yeah. You know, is this a critique of my design ability or is it something else? He's telling me he needs a therapeutic environment. Okay, let's do that. Duncan Fife goes away. And here we have a more neutral, less stimulating space that doesn't make it to a magazine anywhere for any reason, but makes his life easier, my life easier. We're talking about my son. And then we build place attachment, object permanence. You have some control. You have a say. I hear you. I see your big feelings. That's what this is about, to become offended that my style is an N, or I don't get to have my zigzags on the wall or whatever it is that I want. It's all transitional and it builds and scaffolds one into another.
It's an interesting shift of thinking for educators, because I know educators, especially at the elementary and then, you know, then also at the middle school, not maybe not quite as high school, because then it's starting to get sort of bare on the walls. They're trying to do the things that they think students are going to be interested in that are trendy, and they spend a lot of caretaking time, you know, designing the bulletin boards and all of those things. And so what you're introducing is a shift in the way to think about that, you know, that we're thinking about their nervous systems as opposed to thinking about the popular culture. And also back to what Jen was saying, where you want their eyes to go and what you want the function to be. Those are different ways of looking at it, and you're still building it exactly for them. I mean, it is all about the students. You know, instead of stimulating their pop culture, we're trying to, you know, stimulate their nervous systems in the correct ways, or not overstimulate them if the case is there, right?
I think it allows us also to not only center humans in our space and our needs in those spaces, but just center learning. One of the things that we talk about in the guide is that if all we do on our walls is showcase the completed work that students have accomplished, the artwork that's already finished, the writing project that's done and in completion, we're missing the process of learning. And we can showcase that, and we can design our classrooms to center that process of learning, mm-hmm. so that folks are seeing the messy middle and how we work through challenges together, and how learning isn't linear and growth isn't linear, that there's steps back and there's mistakes, and how do we grapple with that together? How do we support each other through it and really honor our vulnerability in that process? Because that allows us to take the risks where powerful learning and creative new ideas are generated too.
That goes to what I was wanting to talk about with engagement. What are we engaging them to do? You know, is engagement excitement? Oh, I have red chairs and purple chairs and I can pick between them. You know, is that engagement, or is it the example that you gave of the library? You know, where the engagement was the books, you're drawing them right to it. You're not distracting from it. And it highlights what is education and what do we want our students to be engaged in doing, actually. I love the messy middle. We do that a lot in Design Studio, and it's very difficult for people to show their work, their initial ideas, their messy stuff, their drafts. But oh my gosh, that's the glory of learning right there. It's mm-hmm. such a great process, and it would be wonderful to see it at the younger levels.
Interesting, Anna, because it reminds me of a story that I haven't thought of for a long time, but I'm a daughter of an industrial arts teacher at the high school level, and I grew up in the high school shop, which was not my favorite place to be. It was dirty and it was greasy, and yeah, it just wasn't really my thing. But I'll never forget my dad's bulletin board, and he still has a board like this in his shop at home, which is where all of his creativity happens. It has his sketches, it has his drawings, it has his process of creation there. And he used that kind of a display in his classroom for students to share their processes too. And that's really what we're talking about.
You know, I'm also sitting here thinking and realizing that all four of us have been parents with kids with exceptional needs, and that these strategies would be great in the home as well. I mean, obviously, Anna, growing at home, that is what you do too. But I wouldn't mind just using this quick guide to think about the spaces in my home that I need for me to be a regulated adult and feel safe, and then for my kids as well. So
one of the tips that we give in the guide, I'll give one more away, is the power of nature and bringing mm-hmm. nature into our classrooms, or taking our classrooms out to nature too. But just the power of whether it's live plants in the room, if you can do that, or a nature scene up on your screen during a transition or during a writing time, or a video of an underwater scene with fish and music to it. Just those are really small, easy to make changes that we can do in our classrooms. Mm-hmm. And there's so many other small changes like that, whether it's in our homes, in our schools, that we can make that really do make a difference for folks.
I don't know where I was. It must have been a conference, but I was listening to a teacher talk about how by accident she came across, you know, live cam footage of, you know, the eagle mom in the nest with the babies. And she just put it up on the screen, you know, to kind of bring some calm and focus into the classroom. Well, the kids became so invested in it. You know, it brought so much regulation into the room, and they were so invested in those babies and the eaglets leaving the nest. And I thought, well, who would have thought, you know, but that was a simple tool that she used.
This is such good information. And in a guide like this, you give it to us in such an accessible way. Tell us quickly how to get the guide. We'll make sure that we put it in the show notes as well.
Sure. You can purchase it anywhere that you like to purchase books. It can be ordered from any site of your choosing or independent bookseller that you would like to invest in. It's also available on the Brooks Publishing website, and there's a website dedicated to the entire guide series. So you can check back to see what new titles are being added. The next one coming out is all about executive function, particularly working memory, what we can do in schools to support not only students in their working memory needs, but adults and families as well. So keep checking back. There will be new titles that are adding all the time. It's really exciting. And creating a regulating classroom environment is there and accessible right now.
Parents could also pick up and gift to their classroom teachers, right?
Yes.
And Anna, how can people get a hold of your work?
You can go to my website, growing-at-home.com, and just connect with me there, or you can email me, growingathomewithanna@gmail.com. Both will get to me. Workshops, training, you know, pitch something. I'd like to know what you need to learn.
My website as well, msjenalexander.com, as well as social media. Love to connect with folks all about building trauma-sensitive schools.
Jen is a part of our PD collaborative. And every time, Jen, you speak, you just, you know, drop the mic. I don't know how else to better say it, but it's just so much good stuff. The work you're doing is so good. We will definitely link you both in the show notes so that people can get a hold of you and your
exactly.
work.
Exactly. So because our listeners are probably driving, or maybe they're practicing some self-care, walking or, you know, running or whatever it is that they're doing while they're listening. So it's in the show notes, folks, that you can just click on through and get to Anna or Jen as quickly as possible. Ladies, this has been really fun. Is there anything in closing that either one of you wants us to know that we didn't ask you today?
I'm just so grateful to be here, be able to have this conversation, because it is kind of out of left field for most people. It's like, you know, but I love my this or my that. It's a way, though, to help another person. It's a way to help yourself.
Right. If it makes it easier for everybody to get regulated and be ready to learn, then it's a win for everybody.
Anna, you have been doing this for so long and been a mom now for so long that you're coming from this perspective of, I wish we had this information so long ago, you know, yes. Now it's like, oh, yay, we're talking about it. And so I can feel that from you and well, from all of us here, that we're just so happy to have the opportunity to share this information that would have helped us so much 20, 30, 40 years ago, you know. Yeah.
Thanks so much for having us. And I think the last thing I want to say is thank you to educators for the work that you're doing. It makes a difference. I don't think you hear that near enough as you need to and deserve to. And we promise we're not asking you to put more on your plate. It's more rather, how do we help you arrange that plate so it's meeting your needs and your students' needs too? And above all, we appreciate everything you do for kids.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, you guys. That's what we know about you, that you guys are 100% behind the educators and helping them on their trauma-sensitive journey, as we are here at ATN. That's part of the reason we all mesh so well, right? Is that we've got a shared passion and mission in that. Thank you all for listening today. Please check out the show notes for information on how to get this quick guide and learn more about what we've talked about today. So we'll catch everybody in our next episode.
This has been another episode of Regulated and Relational. Join us next time when Julie and Ginger will be exploring our internal working models and how they develop. A special thanks to Lorraine Schneider, our editor, and Joe Kramer for donating our music. For more information about the Attachment and Trauma Network, visit our website at attachtrauma.org. Show notes and upcoming episodes will be available on our website and through anchor.fm. I'm Danny Pankratz. Thanks for listening.